So everybody's surviving our semi or bi-weekly storms that we get out there. If it isn't ice, it's snow, it's drifting, but that's winter in Northern Ontario and apparently Newfoundland. It could be worse. Anyway, before I start, I just want to make one other announcement, just a reminder that the men's Bible study, we started it this past Monday and it's continuing on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. Now, we're continuing on in our study through the Gospel of Luke, and last week, in the end of chapter 5, you probably will remember that it ended with Jesus giving this parable in which he talked about old wineskins and new wineskins, and how you don't put new wine into an old wineskin, because when it starts to ferment, it'll burst the old wineskin. And then he also talked about the fact that people who have drank old wine, they don't want new wine. They're comfortable with the old. So they prefer the old over the new. Now, what Jesus was alluding to here was how people tend to be most comfortable with that which they're most familiar with. What they've been doing all along is what they prefer to continue doing. And they don't necessarily adapt to change well. In case you don't believe that, just think about yourself and your get up in the morning routine, especially if you're a coffee drinker. Most of the coffee drinkers I know, and my wife is one of them, they got to have that first cup of coffee somewhere in the first half hour to 45 minutes. And if they don't, it's almost like the day's not worth living. And then try to suggest to them that, well, maybe you shouldn't have coffee in the morning. Let's switch it out, have water or juice. Forget it. That just isn't going to work, is it, Ted? So we're not, by nature, all of us, none of us, are all that adaptable. I mean, we can make ourselves more adaptable, but we don't necessarily like it. And Jesus, though, was addressing that parable, though, to the Pharisees. And what he was indicating here was that he knew that they were so comfortable with the traditions that they had been following that they were going to have a hard time accepting the new things that he was going to be introducing. And in fact, chapter 6, where we're going to be reading today, starts out with two incidents that illustrate that fact perfectly. So let's start at chapter 6 of Luke's Gospel, verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" But Jesus, answering them, said, "Have you not even read this, what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God, took and ate the showbread, and also gave some to those with him, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat. And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath.'" Now, I guess the first question that pops into my mind when I read this is, why did the Pharisees call the action of the disciples unlawful? On what grounds were they declaring it to be that way? Well, I can tell you right off the top, it wasn't because the Old Testament law forbade what they were doing in the grain field here. You can look throughout every part of the Old Testament law, and you will not find an area there where it declares that preparing food on the Sabbath is unlawful. In fact, the only passage that I could find that even connected the two, that is, food preparation and the Sabbath, is the one that you see at the top there on Exodus chapter 12. And what you'll see there is that it's actually endorsed. This is talking about the Passover. And in the Passover, it started with the Sabbath day, and the last day was a Sabbath day. And here's what is said in it. "On the first day, there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day, there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but only that which everyone must eat. That only may be prepared by you." So food preparation on the Sabbath was explicitly allowed. And I would suggest that what the disciples were doing with this grain would qualify as food preparation. They were simply plucking the grain and then rubbing it to clean it so that they could eat it. So it's not declared unlawful on that grounds. So maybe the Pharisees were thinking, well, you guys are stealing. You know, it's not your field out there, so maybe what you're doing there, you're stealing somebody else's stuff, and that's why it's unlawful. Well, the Old Testament has a passage that addresses that, and that's Deuteronomy 23 there, where it says, when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. So this is talking about a situation where maybe travelers are passing through or people are just poor. And the Old Testament law allowed people to go into the grain fields, also vineyards, and just pick what they could with their hands and eat it. But they weren't allowed to take a sickle to the grain because that would be more like harvesting. You know, you're taking too much. But what you could eat with your hands, that was okay. And it was one of the ways of kind of subsidizing the poor in the nation. So here we got the law addressing the two possible things that the Pharisees could have been thinking about as far as it being unlawful because of Old Testament law. So if it wasn't Old Testament law that they were appealing to, then what was it? Well, it had to be something else. And commentators tell us that it was most likely the Jewish traditions of the day. And because of that, I agree with that, we're going to look at something that's called the Oral Torah. Now, you may have heard that word Torah. The word Torah refers to the first five books of the Bible: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. These books were basically given to Moses. God spoke to Moses, gave them to him, and then Moses wrote them down. And that's why we have them today. And that's why those five books of the Bible are called the written Torah. Now, Israelites in the day when God gave Moses the law would have understood how to carry out those things because they were just given. So there are certain places within the written Torah where it says, do this as God commanded, but it doesn't necessarily specify how God commanded it to be done. As I said, the Israelites then would have devised a way and would have known how to do it. But Jewish leaders in the centuries after that came to believe that, well, we've kind of lost some of that information. So what they began to believe was that at the same time God gave the Israelites the written Torah, he also gave them what's called the oral Torah. Now, this isn't recorded in the Old Testament. This is just their idea and that it was passed down. Now, if you could just bring up the next slide here. This is an explanation about this by a man named Barry Holtz in his book called Back to the Sources. And here's what he says about the oral Torah. He says, ancient rabbis taught that the revelation granted to Moses had been delivered in two forms, a smaller revelation in writing and the larger one kept orally. This oral Torah had been transmitted faithfully by the leaders of each generation to their successors, by Moses to Joshua, and then to the elders, then to the prophets, to the men of the great assembly, to the leaders of the Pharisees, and finally to the earliest rabbis. Thus, only these rabbis knew the whole Torah, written and oral, and only such knowledge could qualify anyone for legitimate leadership over the people of Israel. That last line there, I think, is very helpful in understanding the attitude of the Pharisees. They believed that they were the only ones who had the special education, training, and knowledge to be the spiritual leaders of the people, which helps to explain one of the reasons why they resented Jesus so much. There were other reasons that come up, and you'll see it later, but this kind of defines what was behind their attitude here. Now, this oral Torah contained a lot of interpretations of the written Torah. You know, try to understand how to carry these things out. Plus, it contained a whole slew of additional rules. Now, if you were to read this oral Torah, you would probably see that many of these interpretations were practical. I've read some of them, and they make sense. But then you'll also see that there's all these extra rules and regulations, and many of them would be somewhat over the top. Let me give you an example of one. In the written Torah, it was not permitted for a person to plow their fields on the Sabbath. And the reason was is because on the Sabbath day, not only were people required to rest, but their animals as well. So since you plowed with animals, you wouldn't be allowed to plow on the Sabbath. Well, in the oral Torah, it was decided that in order to prevent people from accidentally plowing, we're not going to allow people to carry sticks. So if you were walking in Israel on the Sabbath, you could not carry a walking stick with you or a stick of any kind, because what might happen is you might accidentally let it drag behind you and you'd plow a little furrow in the ground. And that's plowing. And there are literally hundreds of rules and regulations like that in the oral Torah. I've just given you one. In addition to that, there were extra tithes, and Jesus talked about this. Like, the written Torah had certain tithes that needed to be paid, but the oral Torah had a whole slew of them added to it. Jesus referred to the tithes of the spices on mint and cumin and this type of thing. And Jesus spoke negatively about it because it was imposing burdens on the people that were way above what the written Torah would impose on people. So Jesus wasn't too impressed, and he was quite critical of them. So commentators tell us that this was most likely the source that the Pharisees were appealing to in declaring that the disciples were doing unlawful things in the field here. Now then that leads to the question, well, what specifically did they believe they were doing wrong? Well, the written Torah would forbid harvesting and threshing grain on the Sabbath as well, because that was commercial work. You had six other days in which you could do your commercial work, but not on the Sabbath. Well, again, commentators believe that what the Pharisees were accusing the disciples of here was harvesting and threshing grain. Most would look at it as merely food preparation, but this was likely the grounds that they were using to accuse them. Now, Jesus responds to this, and I find it interesting that Jesus could very well have responded by saying, "You're just referring to man-made rules and regulations that are over and above what God imposed, and my disciples don't have to do that." There are other places in the gospel where that's the argument that Jesus used, but not here. You notice here what he does is he introduces an example of an Old Testament character who actually did violate a part of the Old Testament law, but it was okay with God. He's referring to David and this incident with the showbread. Now just turn, if you will, to 1 Samuel chapter 21 and verse 1, and we're going to read that incident. First Samuel 21, and just to set the stage here, what's going on is David and his men have been on the run from King Saul. King Saul has been trying to kill David, just destroy him, and David's got a bunch of men with him, but they're running through the wilderness. You know, they're gone for days or even months on end, and so it says here that David came to Nob, that was a little city there, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" So David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king, that is Saul, has ordered me on some business." This is a lie, by the way. David's on the run, so he's lying so he won't get turned in. "And said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. And I've directed my young men to such and such a place. Now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found.'" You see, they're on the run through the wilderness. They're probably very hungry. You know, you know what it's like. He wouldn't have access to food easily, so they're on the run, and they may even be on the point of exhaustion here. "And so the priest answered David and said, 'There's no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women.' Then David answered the priest and said to him, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. and the vessels of the young men, that's their bodies, are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So you see the situation that Jesus is referring to. You've got David and his men. They're probably really hungry, but the only bread on hand is this showbread. And that showbread was meant to be eaten only by the priests. It was seen to be a holy, set-apart bread for a holy, set-apart priesthood. And it was set up that way by God to be a picture of the holiness of God himself. You see, it was actually a metaphor for God's holiness, and that's why he designed it this way. But in this situation, you had a human need here. And what Jesus is saying is that because of this human need, it's okay to set apart this part of the law. Now, we're not talking about a moral part of the law. Jesus isn't saying that, okay, you can commit adultery sometimes if it's really necessary. That's not the argument here. What this is referring to is what's often called the ceremonial law, the law that has pictures and symbols in it that are meant to be obeyed. But what Jesus is saying, in dire human need, you can set those aside and meet the need. I was trying to think of a sort of a modern day example that illustrated that, and I was thinking about going to a public swimming pool. You go to a public swimming pool almost anywhere, and there's going to be a rule there that you're not allowed to dive off the side of the pool. And the reason for that makes sense. It's a safety issue. If you're diving off the side of the pool into a pool where there's a whole bunch of kids, you possibly are going to land on somebody and injuries are going to occur. So the rule makes sense, just like the rule that Jesus was referring to about the showbread. It makes sense when you understand it. But let's say you're standing on the side of the pool there and a child in the middle there is drowning. And you quickly look over to the lifeguard and the guard is distracted, doing something else. Now, you realize quickly that you could call the guard, gain his or her attention, and maybe in 15 seconds or so, the guard can be there where the kid is. But then you look and you say, I could be there in 2 seconds. So you do it. You dive into the pool, you save the kid, you're the hero. I don't think after the fact that anybody is going to get on that person, get on you, for having violated a pool regulation. Because the human need there to save that child supersedes the regulations. It's just one of those special cases. And I think that's what Jesus is alluding to in the example that he gives here in verse 4. Now, in verse 5, he makes, I think, a rather interesting statement. He says, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. Now, Matthew 12's account includes two other things that Jesus said at the same time that Luke doesn't include, and those were these. He says also, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And then he said that one who is greater than the temple is here, referring to himself. So you put these three statements together, and there's a couple of interesting points that I think Jesus is making. First of all, in saying that I desire mercy and not sacrifice, what he seems to be implying is that, yes, Sabbath law has rules and regulations that are meant to be obeyed, but there can be a time and a place when they can be set aside, particularly, again, as I'm saying, the ceremonial law, not the moral absolutes. And in setting those aside, you can sometimes actually demonstrate mercy. God would prefer that we demonstrate mercy in these Sabbath regulations than to stick to the rigid letter of the law if there's a human need. So that's an important message that Jesus is conveying. The other is that in saying that he's greater than the temple and that he's Lord of the Sabbath, he's declaring that he has the absolute authority to say the things to the Pharisees that he's saying, to teach these principles. Because what he's actually saying is that he is God himself. As God, God is the one who created the Sabbath. He created the Sabbath for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so he's got the right and authority to say all the things that he's saying. So what he's doing is he's continuing on in that thing I mentioned a few weeks ago in making the connection between the Messiah and God, that the Messiah, in fact, is God. Okay, let's read now verses 6 to 11. Now it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts, and said to the man who had the withered hand, "Arise and stand here." And he arose and stood. Then Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy?" And when he had looked around at them all, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. But they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. Now you notice here that this happens on a Sabbath again. Was this a coincidence? All these things keep happening on Sabbaths. Was this a coincidence? Or was Jesus deliberately setting things up here in order to get into the face of the Pharisees on this issue? I think that's exactly what he was doing. He was deliberately confronting the Pharisees on an issue where they had a big problem. Now, one of the things I find interesting, though, about this is that the traditions of the Pharisees actually did allow for treatment or healing on the Sabbath, but only on a person who was at risk of losing his or her life. So in Israel in those days, if you blew out your low back, for example, in the morning of the Sabbath, you could not call your chiropractor till sunset because it's not usually a life or death situation. Jesus, his mind on it, would not be in line with the thinking of the Pharisees, these traditions. He didn't go along with that. And a large part of the reason for that was because it would not be a demonstration of mercy. When somebody's hurting now and needs help now, it's certainly not merciful to make them wait another 12 hours before they get any kind of relief. And so Jesus goes right at them. And he introduces this man with the withered hand. Now, this withered hand here, the word there for withered refers to shriveled. So he basically had a hand that didn't look like this. See, you look at your hands there and they look full, all the rest, whereas the hand of this man, the muscles would be all atrophied and they would be shrunken down like this. Now, how did that happen? Well, there's multiple possible reasons for it. Most likely nerve damage of some kind. It may have been a crushed nerve. It could have been a severed nerve, infection, or maybe he'd had a stroke. Or maybe he was born that way. We're not told. We just know that the hand was useless, and he mentions that it was his right hand as well, which reinforces the idea of the disability. Since most people are right-handed, and he mentions it, it's quite likely that this was being even more of a disability than had it been the left. So the stage is set. You've got a man here with a problem. You got Jesus here who is becoming notorious for doing stuff on the Sabbath that Pharisees don't like, and you got the Pharisees watching to see if he's going to do it again. So what does Jesus do? Well, he starts by asking what I think is a really clever question. He asks them a question which I think is designed to put the Pharisees between a rock and a hard place, because no matter how they answer, they're going to condemn themselves. If they say, yes, it is good, or it is right or lawful to do good and save life on the Sabbath, then after Jesus heals the man, they can hardly have a reason to criticize him, right? I mean, how could they criticize him if they've already agreed that, yeah, it's okay to do this on the Sabbath? But if they say no, then they're going to kind of come across as nasty and mean and maybe even unrighteous in front of all of these people. And they don't want that. So what do? Nothing. One of the other Gospels tells us that they were silent. And what it tells us here is that Jesus looked around at them. Mark's Gospel also adds the detail that when he looked around at the Pharisees, because they were silent, He got angry. And the reason why he got angry was this. Jesus knew that what they really wanted to answer was, no, it's not right to do that on the Sabbath. He knew that they would prefer that he don't heal this man on the Sabbath. But he also knew they wouldn't admit it, not in front of all those people. And in Jesus' mind, that was demonstrating hypocrisy of the highest degree. He knew that the Pharisees loved to portray themselves as good and righteous and caring for the people that they were leading, but he knew that deep down, that wasn't what they were really like. And so what he does then is he heals the man. Now, I find it rather intriguing, though, that in the healing itself, he calls on the man to demonstrate some faith. You notice what he tells the man to do? Stretch out your hand. Well, a man with a withered hand, that's the very thing he can't do. He probably hasn't been able to do it for years. But Jesus tells him to do the very thing that you haven't been able to do all this time. What he's looking for is faith. And he sees it. The man responds in faith. He stretches out his hand, and Jesus responds by instantly healing him. Now, what about the response of the Pharisees? You know, if they were half as good and righteous and caring for their own people as they'd like their people to believe, you would think they'd be thrilled at this man getting healed like this. I mean, think about it. The man, his right hand is withered, so he probably has had a hard time making a living for himself, supporting his family if he has one. And now he's been restored. His hand is whole, just like the other, so he can become a fully productive member of a society that does a lot of manual labor. He can actually do this stuff. You would think the Pharisees would be happy about this, but they weren't at all. They were furious. Now that raises the question, well, why? You know, was this a matter of them being concerned because they felt that Jesus was a spiritual fraud and that he was leading the people down the garden path, and they were so concerned with the spiritual welfare of the people that they thought this shouldn't be happening, we just got to get rid of Jesus? Was that it? I don't think so. I think this was a matter of pride, pure and simple. You see, Jesus had just made them all look bad. They had lost face in the eyes of the people. And losing face is bad for everyone, but in Middle Eastern and Eastern cultures, it's even worse. I used to do studies on Eastern cultures like Chinese and Japanese, and the idea of losing face, if you lost enough face in a particular incident, you were basically expected to commit suicide. I mean, that was the only remedy in ancient Japanese society. Now, these people, I don't know if they were thinking that bad, but they were certainly concerned that their power and their prestige with the people was rapidly disappearing because of what Jesus had done. See, Jesus knew that these people were all about power, prestige, and how it looked. Let me just read to you a passage from Matthew 23 where Jesus explains what the Pharisees are really all about. Matthew 23, verse 5, talking about them, he says, "But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments." So that's an appearance thing. "They love the best places at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi." That's Jesus talking about the Pharisees. So knowing all of that, you can see why he deliberately confronts them on issues like this. It's partly to expose them to the people who they're claiming to be able to lead. So, some concluding thoughts, if you could just bring those up on the screen. Got three of them. If you have the sheet there, I've got them printed out there as well. So first of all, we've learned the source of the Pharisees' traditions, that is the oral Torah, and how willing they were to allow these traditions to supersede even the commands of God and his intentions for how those commands should be administered. Second, we've seen Jesus confront the Pharisees and their traditions and declare that he had the right to do so because he is God. Again, repeatedly making that connection between the Messiah and God. And you're going to see Jesus do that over and over again throughout the Gospels. It almost always gets him in trouble, but he does it anyway. And ultimately, that's a big part of the reason why they had him crucified in the end. And then the third, we've seen Jesus expose the hypocrisy of the spiritual leaders who the people are following. He's gradually revealing to the people that to follow him, they will have to make a break from that which is familiar, the Pharisees' teachings, and move into something new, Jesus and his teachings. See, this goes back to that idea of the wineskins. You know, the old cannot contain the new. The old traditions of the Pharisees can't contain the new teachings that Jesus is about to bring. And so it's going to force people to make choices, to abandon the old in order to follow Christ. And you'll see that epitomized in John chapter 9. In John's Gospel chapter 9, that's the story where Jesus heals a man who was born blind. And after that man was healed by Jesus, he had a confrontation with the Pharisees, the leaders in the synagogue. And in that confrontation, this man took sides with Jesus. What did they do to him? They kicked him out of the synagogue. He was cast out. Now, that was a big deal in those days. To be cast out of the synagogue meant not only that were you separated from your religion, you were separated socially and culturally as well. It's bad enough to be put out of a church, but put out of a synagogue in that culture, that was a big deal. But that's the price that man paid for taking sides with Jesus. And I think what Jesus repeats throughout the Gospels is that's what's going to happen. Even in our culture today, in our society today, when you take sides for Jesus, whether to become born again or defend biblical principles in the face of what's being taught in our culture today, there can often be a price to pay. It could be within your family, it could be within the workplace or friends, whatever. There will often be a price to pay. And when we're confronted with that price, Jesus calls upon us to take the stand for him. Let's close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, again, your word is just so rich with teachings and truths here. And as much as what we've looked at today, we know that we've only scratched the surface. There's so much more. And we just pray that doing the studies as we're doing here might be an inspiration for all of us to plunge into your word and pull out as much as we can out of it. And we pray that your spirit would give us all of the information and understanding and wisdom that we need in order to cope with the world in which we live in. So we ask these things and commit ourselves into your care. In Jesus' precious name, amen.